Welcome back. Yes, after a little bit of a long time there, welcome back to the Archaeology News Weekly. I am, of course, David Connolly. I should say, and thank you so much for your patience, it is really good to be back on air again. I have been many things. I'm afraid I've been incredibly busy doing archaeology all over Scotland, and I'm afraid I've been ill as well with a nasty chest infection, which would have put a bit of a gravelly tone to the weekly news. At the moment, I actually am having great fun on an archaeological commercial site somewhere in Scotland, I can't say where just now, where we are excavating some fabulous Roman archaeology with some really excellent archaeologists as well. In addition to that, I have to say that we're going to welcome a new member to the team, Debbie, who is helping to edit the articles for the podcast. So, from Diego, Dave Horrocks, Dave, and Debbie, and of course myself, David, you notice that we're all called D's there. Well, thank you for listening and supporting Archaeology News Weekly from, if you're working in Norway or you're in a university department in Australia, perhaps you're walking about in the deserts of California or listening to us in a commercial unit in Scotland, from France to a home in South Africa. It's basically thank you to all the thousands of you who are listening to us around the world and making this such a success. So, apologies once more for not being on the air for so long, but as you can hear, I sound better and I'm back in action. So let's get back to the present and start as we should. This news is brought to you in partnership between Stone Pages and the British Archaeological Jobs and Resources website. All the stories have been collected from various sources, and to view details on each story, including the source, please see the Stone Pages website at news.stonepages.com. A new portal tomb, a new portal dolmen. You see, I've started, I've lost it already. A new portal dolmen may lie hidden in southwest Wales. Tregeseal stone circle in Cornwall is being damaged by cattle, and did Neanderthals adapt and innovate? Well, we'll have a look. Tools found in Arabia and India may indicate an earlier migration, and a huge ancient grinding stone is discovered in India. At the other end of the scale, an ancient seal is found in Turkey, and still in Turkey, 8,500-year-old bodies are found in Bursa. We then report on an excavation of an Iron Age necropolis in central Spain, and exciting news on 100 new rock art sites found in Somaliland. Reconstructing the Paleolithic diet, well, this report looks at what has been found, and the home of the ice giant Thors, showing ancient hunts in Norway. And Iron Age sites are revealed from the air in Shropshire. And finally, French president gains access to threatened cave art, Sacrebleu. Throughout Western Britain, there are a few lucky sites that have escaped the wandering eye of the antiquarian. One of these sites is Trefail Stone, located north of the Nevern Valley, comprising a single flat monolith that stands around 130 metres above mean sea level. The site is on the land belonging to Codfryn Farm and was first recorded in the late 1920s by W.F. Grimes, then Inspector of Ancient Monuments for Wales. At that time, the stone was recorded on one of its sides as to having 45 shallow cup marks, the average cup mark measuring around about 5 centimetres in diameter. According to archaeologist Francis Lynch, this now tilted stone may have once been a capstone belonging to a Neolithic burial monument. In the recent past, the stone appears to have been severely damaged, possibly from the plough, resulting in the removal of a large stone flake that may have contained further rock art. Curiously, possibly associated with the Trefail Stone, was a nearby standing stone that was located in an adjacent field. The provenance, age and use of this stone is unknown. However, one cannot ignore the fact that standing stones have an association with Neolithic and later prehistoric burial ritual monuments within the corner of Wales. A geophysical survey undertaken by members of the Welsh Rock Art Organisation, well, a superb organisation, well worth having a look at their website, by the way, around the Trefail Monument in September this year, has revealed the probability of the shallow remains of a kidney-shaped mound around the stone. The survival of this important architectural feature, along with the stone itself, probably Lynch's capstone, suggests that Trefail was once a portal dolmen, one of Western Britain's earliest Neolithic burial ritual monuments. The National Monitoring Authority, CADU, have given permission for the team to excavate over a period of only 5 days, a five a 4 meter square area around the stone in order to ascertain the upper extent of the probable cairn that was identified during the recent geophysical survey. Following excavation, the team will also record the cup mark surface and include any further rock art that may lie below the present ground level. Well, I hope that team works quickly. With only 5 days allowed, good luck to them. As I said, good idea to Google Welsh Rock Art Organisation. I have to confess that they are, in fact, dear friends of ours, and see what they've been up to. Moving now to Cornwall in England, a conservation grazing plan is upsetting some of the local community there. Helen Mark of BBC Radio 4 recently went there to report on the reintroduction of cattle to grazing on Penwith Moors, the intention of which was to improve the area's biodiversity. She met with archaeologist Craig Weatherhill at Tregaseel Stone Circle to hear about the damage he says is being caused to the ancient monuments by the horns of the non-native longhorn breed of cattle being grazed on the moors. At Carngalva, one of Cornwall's most unique and prehistoric landscapes, Helen met Peter Bowden from Natural England and John Brooks of the National Trust, who explained the reasons for the conservation grazing scheme and how important it is to the ancient landscape. The heathland is of national and international importance, and the grazing scheme is intended to open up footpaths in a natural way, avoiding the need for heavy machinery and herbicides, as well as fences and cattle grids. Sorry, fences and cattle grids have been put there to keep the cattle in and not people out. When Helen joined Ian Cook and Steve Yandel of Save Penwith Moors campaign, she heard about their concerns for the environment and how emotional they felt to see barbed wire fences appearing out on the moors. At Trengwinton Farm near Penzance, farmer Stephen Bone took Helen to part of the land that his father fenced and grazed 40 years ago, and which soon became waist-high in bracken when the cattle were taken out. Stephen is actually now refencing his land to graze animals there as part of the conservation grazing scheme. He told Helen that he has offered an olive branch to those opposed to the scheme by suggesting that he take his livestock in during the busy summer months and school holidays. Stephen Warman has been brought in to try and resolve the situation and to narrow the gap between the two opposing sides. Where do they all go from here in order to manage the moors in the best way for all those who care about the landscape? There's certainly a lot of people involved, so hopefully they will work things out. I'll say this, however, that once a stone is scratched, it can't be repaired, so perhaps we should be putting little corks in the ends of their horns. On a serious note, though, up here in Scotland, we've been looking at hill forts, for example, in the Lammermuirs, and the thing you're seeing is bracken spreading across these sites, and in fact, the damage done beneath the surface is quite remarkable. So, good ideas to get in grazing animals, like sheep, like cows, which will keep this down. However, that actually then creates its own problems with sheep scrapes, and of course the cows wandering backwards and forwards, creating these nasty sort of paths through it. So hopefully they will find a solution. Finding solutions to switching to early humans, or in this case possibly subhuman theories. A professor of anthropology at the University of Colorado in Denver, USA, thinks that the Neanderthal contribution to human culture and development has been underrated. Julian Real Salvatore has been studying Neanderthal sites in Italy for 7 years. His article, to be published in December in the Journal of Archaeological Method and Theory, proposes that Neanderthals in southern Italy adapted to climate change by developing new hunting strategies. According to Salvatore, 40,000 years ago, three cultures occupied Italy. The Orognations in the north were Cro-Magnon. The central part of what is now Italy was home to the much older Mousterian culture, which was Neanderthal. And in the south, a new culture emerged, the Ulusians, also thought to be Neanderthal. The Ulusians are believed to have been geographically separated from the modern humans in the north. Ulusian sites have yielded projectile points, bone tools, ornaments and ochre. There's also evidence of fishing and hunting of small game. These innovations are not typically found at Neanderthal settlements. Salvatore argues that the Ulusians were forced to adapt as the geography of their home became more open and dry. The large animals they hunted with spears were becoming scarce, and so they had to develop projectiles for smaller game. The question is whether or not the Ulusians were Neanderthals, and whether they were in fact isolated from modern humans. He states, "My conclusion is that if the Eleusinian is a Neanderthal culture, it suggests that contacts with modern humans are not necessary to explain the origins of their new behaviour. This stands in contrast to the ideas of the past 50 years that Neanderthals had to be acculturated to humans to come up with this new technology. When we show Neanderthals could innovate on their own, it casts them in a new light. It, in effect, humanizes them." Salvatore also makes a case that Neanderthals did not die out because they could not compete with modern humans. He believes that they were absorbed due to a higher birth rate amongst Cro-Magnons. The fact that Neanderthals could adapt to new conditions and innovate shows that they are culturally similar to us, he said. Biologically, they are also similar, and he believes that they are a subspecies of human, but not a different species. It's like the Neanderthals were absorbed by modern humans. This theory will likely be debated for some time, like so many, as it is 50 years in the making. This will be an interesting article to read, nonetheless. Stone tools have been found far inland in the Arabian Peninsula and India, indicating that humans may have travelled by land rather than by boat. The implements, mainly arrowheads and scrapers, have been dated by geologists in the looking at the surrounding sand and volcanic ash, most particularly the ash from the famous Toba eruption of 75,000 years ago. Previous genetic research on modern humans that look at different populations to calculate the length of time to find a common ancestor has dated human migration to 60,000 years ago. Dr. Petra Gellia of Oxford University, who led the research team, comprised of colleagues from Australia and India, suggested at the British Science Festival that the absence of ancient DNA to make additional tests made this area of investigation much less reliable. He stated, "I believe that multiple populations came out of Africa in the period between 120 and 70,000 years ago. And there is evidence in stone tools that we can date." Chris Stringer from the Natural History Museum has another explanation for this difference in findings between genetic research. He says these tools show that the people were in these regions, but the genetic data shows an exit from Africa of later than 60,000 years. The people in India could have died out. They hope to continue excavations in this region and perhaps find out some more about the truth. Do archaeologists look for the truth or just facts? There's your interesting thought for the day. Anyway, continuing in India, workers of the Tamil Nadu Highways Department unwittingly became excavators as they stumbled upon an ancient granite structure, possibly a lime-crushing stone, while digging a trench for constructing a subway on Darga Road in Old Pallavaram in India. Following earlier finds of cairns by the Archaeological Survey of India, Old Pallavaram has been notified as a megalithic site. ASI officials will inspect the grinding stone to ascertain its age and possible connection with prehistoric communities that are believed to have lived there. The road workers found the ancient stone at a depth of 3 metres. The wheel is 12 feet in diameter and weighs about 4.5 tonnes. Hundreds of residents thronged to the site to catch a glimpse of this giant circular object. It looks like a major find. We've informed officials of the State Archaeology Department about the discovery. Officials said that the object could not be an ancient wheel, since there was no hole in the stone that could be used to fit it to a cart. That's going to be some cart with 12 feet diameter, 4.5 ton wheels. But anyway, they decided it looks more like a crushing stone used many centuries ago to crush lime for whitewashing buildings. That's better. There are no visible inscriptions on it, though. Archaeologists who are expected to inspect the stone may be able to throw light on its origin by analysing its structure and nature. Right, from the large to the small, where in western Turkey a seal believed to date back to 6200 BCE has been discovered. The site is located at the Yeslova Tumulus near Izmir, and excavations are being carried out by the Ege University Department of Archaeology under the leadership of Associate Professor Zafer Derin. The seal is in the shape of 8 petals of a flower and could either have been used as a seal on documents or possibly as a pattern to pattern fabrics. When talking about the importance of the site, the mayor of the area is quoted as saying that they've organised an architectural project competition for the area, and jury are now evaluating projects. When the project is chosen, we'll establish an exhibition and education centre. The excavations have also uncovered several artefacts which help to identify the inhabitants of the time. Professor Derin says, Findings obtained from the excavation determined that those who lived in the area 8,500 years ago had an organised society and were related to the people who lived in Anatolia. There are clues that they also had commercial relations with the people in the Anatolian region. Now for some gruesome news in Turkey, where five bodies, believed to be 8,500 years old, have been unearthed at a burial mound in the Akçakçaklar area of the Marmara province of Bursa. The bodies, comprising of two adults and three children between the ages of 3 and 5 years old, were found at the Akçakçaklık mound. Oh, I'm sure I've got that one horribly wrong. According to the associate professor Nekmi Karul, head of the Prehistory Department at Istanbul's University Literature Faculty. Their arms were tied behind their backs, indicating that they may have been killed or sacrificed, although at the moment it's too early to tell particular details, such as whether the bodies belonged to a single family. Girl described how one of the children was found hog-tied, whilst the others were found between the legs of the adults. Carol said that the team have been working on the site every summer for the past 7 years and have been reaching important traces of Neolithic and Chalcolithic periods. The information will not only enlighten Bursa's history, but also serve for all humanity as a lesson. Well, what a gruesome way to go there. A team of archaeologists and archaeology students from the United States, Spain, Ireland and Britain recently worked on an archaeological dig to unearth an Iron Age necropolis dating to the 5th century BCE at the settlement of Pintia in central Spain. The crew excavated 9 cremation tombs belonging to the Vaquia culture, adding to the nearly 200 burials discovered over the past decade at the site. The Vaquians were an early Celtic society in northern Europe, who founded the cities of Palantia and Pintia. Research is nice, that's very sort of poetic, that one. Research in the area of the site is helping investigators better understand the social organisation of these pre-Roman people. 2 notable tombs were found almost completely intact, including several ceramic pendants carved to resemble metallic jewellery. The Pintia participants learned excavation and surveying techniques, plus how to work with and catalogue artefacts. Now, while we're here, actually, it's worth also mentioning the fabulous, yes, I'm going to say it, Past Horizons website. It's actually undergoing a massive makeover just now. However, you can still access the World Project System. That's got over 300 projects that you, yes, you, can get involved in as a volunteer around the world. And indeed, one of them is this site. So what's stopping you? Get yourself along to Past Horizons and have a look at the world projects. One that's not on Past Horizons system, and I wish it was, I would love to be on this, is in Somaliland. Anyway, a team of Somali archaeologists led by Dr. Sada Meyer of the Institute of Archaeology, University College, London, has found scores of previously unstudied rock paintings in the Eastern African country. The art depicts wildlife in motion, antelopes, snakes and giraffes. Some are dated to about 5000 BCE. One very unique find is the first known rock painting of a mounted hunter. It was created around 4000 years ago. According to Mira, the art is exceptional. These are amongst the best prehistoric paintings in the world, she said. Yet Somaliland is a country whose history is totally hidden. With wars, droughts and piracy in Somalia, hardly anyone has researched the archaeology until now, but it's absolutely full of extraordinarily well-preserved rock art. It's expected that some of the sites are so valuable that they will be granted World Heritage status by the United Nations. At Dumbalin near the Red Sea, the rocks revealed 5,000-year-old images of sheep and goats. Bands painted on the animals may indicate farming or some ritual connection. Some of the paintings seem to show a sort of shorthand with cattle represented only by necks or horns. There are also depictions of full and half moons and geometric symbols. Mara argues that these are mystical representations of time and space. Somaliland lies in the north of Somalia. It's got a population of 3.5 million people in an area slightly smaller than England. Somaliland declared independence from Somalia in 1991, but has not yet been recognised as a separate country by the United Nations. Many of the inhabitants are nomads who have long known about the rock art. In 2000, cave paintings were discovered at Lasgil. The local people believe the site was haunted by evil spirits. The findings of Meyer and her team will be published in the September issue of Current World Archaeology. There are nothing more exciting than being allowed to see such a find. If the UN can grant the World Heritage status, maybe they'll recognise the country it is in. I wonder how they can handle that. Well, we'll see, I suppose. An interdisciplinary team of scientists has been assembled by the Unilever Corporation, a major manufacturer of food, home care and personal products, to study the diet of our early ancestors and to determine how it might improve our health today. The group brings expertise in botany, anthropology, archaeology and genetics to the problem. Early humans are believed to have eaten 20 to 25 plant-based foods daily. In contrast, many people today struggle to consume the recommended 5 portions of fruit and vegetables. Whether a plant-based diet is healthier or more in tune with our genetically defined nutritional needs is one of the questions the scientists plan to address. Also of interest is whether we have evolved since the Paleolithic to need a different diet. The head of the team, Dr. Mark Berry, good name there, explains the research project. Some scientists have theorized for years that the Paleolithic diet is more compatible with human physiology than our diet today. This is because evolution is an extremely slow process and changes in our diet have outpaced changes in our genetic makeup. Well, using cutting-edge scientific techniques, the research employs a new way of looking at diet, examining our evolutionary biology to provide greater enlightenment than ever before. They hope to unlock the secrets of the past and in doing so, potentially identify key nutrients in the diet of cavemen, which might offer nutritional benefits to the people of today. We're at the start of the journey, but the scientific leads and new insights generated from this could be potentially amazing. I find it remarkable just how we are continually improving our lives today because of what we're learning from archaeology. It's why archaeology and anthropology are so important. The historical knowledge is priceless. A team headed by Professor Herzl Chai of Tel Aviv University and Israel School of Mechanical Engineering is using a different approach to establish the diet of early humans. Joined by researchers from George Washington University, the US National Institute of Standards and Technology, Chai developed an equation for the relationship between chips and teeth and the force needed to produce them. The work is based upon fracture mechanics, which is commonly used to study rigid non-biological materials. Previous studies of this sort relied upon the mechanics of the jaw, which require nearly complete skull. From the data obtained using the calculations, some information about the diet can be extrapolated. Teeth with many large chips may indicate a hard diet of nuts and seeds or meat with bones. Smaller chips would have been produced with a softer plant-based diet. I wish they would find that actually they went and did sort of takeaways and had pizzas. That's the sort of diet I could go with just now. Ooh. Anyway, from plants to meat. Climate change is exposing reindeer hunting gear used by the Vikings' ancestors faster than archaeologists can collect it from ice thawing above sea level in mid-Norway. In Norway, some ice fields are at their minimum for at least 3,000 years, said Runstrand Odegaard, a glacier and permafrost expert from Norway's Gjøvik University College. Lars Pilo, a Danish scientist heading the team of snowpatch archaeology, reports the findings of specialised hunting sticks, bows and arrows, and even a 3,500-year-old leather shoe from an ice melt in the Jotunheimen Mountains, the home of the ice giants of North mythology. As water streams off the Ufona ice field, Pillow and two other archaeologists collect scare sticks they presume were set up around 1,500 years ago, according to radiocarbon dating that is anyway, in rows that were designed to drive the reindeers towards archers. Jotunheimen is unusual because so many finds are turning up at the same time. 600 artifacts at Jofona alone. Freed from the ancient frieze, wood rots in a few years. Rare feathers used on the arrows, wool or leather crumbles in days unless taken to the laboratory and stored in a freezer. Inside the Jofona ice, experts have carved a cave to expose layers of ice dating back 6,000 years. Some dark patches turned out to be ancient reindeer droppings, giving off quite a pungent smell when they were thawed out. In summer, reindeer often go onto the snow patches to escape parasitic flies. Ice fields like Jufvona differ from glaciers in that they do not slide much downhill, which means that artifacts may be exactly where they were left, giving an insight into hunting techniques. Most finds are scare sticks, which are about a metre long. Each has a separate flapping piece of wood, some 30 centimetres long, that was originally tied to the top. The connecting thread is rarely found since it disintegrates within days of exposure. The archaeologists summarised that they were set up about 2 metres apart and would drive reindeer towards the hunters. Such a hunt would require about 15 to 20 people, indicating that Norway had an organised society around the start of the Dark Ages, 1500 years ago. Until the last 40 years, historians and archaeologists believe that Iron Age ancestors in Shropshire lived almost exclusively on high ground. Conventional wisdom held that the lowlands and river valleys were covered by dense forests. However, recent aerial surveys have revealed a completely different story. The outline of Iron Age forts, farms and other settlements can be seen from the air, buried under fields that have been farmed for centuries. Dr. Andy Wigley, Historic Environment Countryside Advisor for Shropshire Council, explained that the aerial survey evidence had shown actually very dense settlement landscapes and carefully farmed landscapes, which were almost 1,000 years before the Romans appeared. Despite centuries of ploughing, the outlines of Iron Age settlements show up as variations in crop colouring, which can only be seen from the air and only after long periods of dry weather, as it's caused by inconsistencies in soil moisture. In recent years, the weather's been too wet to show up any variations. However, this summer, believe it or not, in Britain, was actually offering the experts an ideal chance to continue their efforts to map the country's buried landscape, due to the fact it was actually quite warm here. Shropshire's many hill forts are largely unchanged, as the high rocky terrain makes them difficult to build on and impractical for growing crops. However, the evidence suggests that lowland areas that were farmed 2,500 years ago are in many cases still farmed today. And finally, yes, I've been looking forward to this story, the perks of rulership. French President Nicolas Sarkozy and his wife there, Carla Bruni, treated themselves to a visit to the most secretive and most threatened art gallery in the world, the Lascaux Caves in the Dordogne. The visit of an 8-strong presidential party to the fragile underground chambers, which contain 900 of the most perfect surviving examples of prehistoric art, was controversial. The caves, banned to the public since 1963, have been menaced in recent years by a series of unexplained and only partially controlled fungal invasions. Any human presence in the cave is regarded as potentially destructive. Normally, they are only entered once a week by one security guard for a few minutes. However, the 8 people of the presidential party spent 30 metres in the 200-metre-long complex of caves. They were, however, under strict instructions to keep moving and to avoid staring at individual paintings. Staring at them, does that damage them? I'm not sure. To compensate for the heat and humidity of their presence, normal security checks were cancelled for 2 weeks. Mr. Sarkozy appeared to have been deeply moved by the visit, though I should hope so anyway, that marked the 70th anniversary of their accidental discovery by four 13-year-old boys and a dog in September 1940. The paintings at Lascaux, now perhaps the best known of all cave paintings in the world, exceeded in quality and quantity anything that had previously been found in Europe. Lascaux was closed to the public in 1963 to protect the caves from just this kind of fungal infection that appears to have been infecting it now. In February 2009, UNESCO threatened to humiliate France by placing Lascaux on its list of endangered sites of universal importance. This followed a series of botched and then partially successful attempts to fight off the first white and then ugly grey and black fungi, which began to creep over the paintings in 2001. An independent committee of concerned scientists had complained that the French government had imposed an omerta, or veil of secrecy, on the site. A new curator appointed last year, Muriel Mauriac, says that the stricter controls on climate within the caves have begun to remove the fungi. But they have a long way to go before they understand the origins of the crisis. Yes, and crisis it is. Why on earth should 8 people go in to this cave is beyond me. Just because one can, I suppose, doesn't mean one should. Anyway, that's it for today. As I have said before, thank you so much for bearing with me. Apologies for all of you who have been missing your dose of the Archaeology News Weekly podcast. You will, of course, be getting news soon about the launch of the new Past Horizons site, which will bring you fabulous news and articles, unique articles, and a constant daily. Well, it's going to be daily as well. Yes, good grief. Will it ever stop? Well, I certainly hope it doesn't. So, can I remind people that many new archaeological and heritage employment opportunities, as well as the UK Heritage Calendar, Library and Guidance section, can be found on my own site at Badger, www.bajr.org. Why not, if you're on Facebook, join us there. Just try and find BAJR or, of course, Past Horizons. You'll find us on Facebook. It would be lovely to see you there. Become one of our fans as well. And finally, you can always find more at Stone Pages website, news.stonepages.com. Thanks for listening to Archaeology News Weekly, and thanks, Debbie, for helping me out in the editing. Brilliant. See you next week, then.